Good morning and welcome back to the Roundtable. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. 12 minutes after 9 o'clock, we'll begin our morning panel discussion on topics in the news. Joining us this morning, WAMC's Alan Shartok.
Good morning, Uncle Ray.
Uncle Ray. University at Albany professor and investigative journalist Rosemary Armeo.
Absent.
She's not here yet.
But I'm sure she'll show.
And
we'll send out a truancy notice for her.
She will. I'm sure she's on her way. And also a very nice guest to have here, Stephen Gottlieb, the J. and Ruth Kaplan Distinguished Professor of Law at Albany Law School. Nice to have you here, Steve.
Thank you, Ray. Good to be here.
What is on your mind lately? What have you been thinking about? You're a Supreme Court expert.
Oh, well. I was just out at a meeting of political scientists in Chicago.
Yeah.
And I had a conversation with a guru of research on campaign finance.
Mm-hmm.
And that conversation was very interesting because he's saying that people cannot find any effect from either Citizens United, or it's really too soon in the McCutcheon case,
mm-hmm.
but the point would extend to that case about campaign finance.
Explain to those listeners who may not be as familiar as you are the importance of the McCutcheon case.
Well, McCutcheon was about the total that you could contribute to different campaigns. And the court said, yeah, there can be a maximum on the amount that you contribute to an individual candidate's campaign, but there can't be a maximum on the total number of contributions you make across the United States to different campaigns. And when you're looking, what Gary Jacobson was really talking about in our conversation was when you're looking at who wins and who loses, that's not driving it.
You mean who wins the case?
Who wins the campaign.
I see.
Because it's just getting matched on both sides. And in addition to that, the really crucial issue is whether your contributions are large enough so you can get your case to the public. Above a certain point, the differences in amounts aren't as significant. So the people that are doing the research on that are not finding that those cases make a big difference. There is a second issue, which is also very interesting, which is even if it doesn't affect who wins the campaign, is it affecting what the winner does? And I think there the problem is that the political scientists are not finding the golden age when people were not influenced by wealthy people in their districts.
There was such a golden age?
That's my point.
Yes.
And so, again, I don't think they're finding that these cases are nearly as significant as the public seems to think that they are. On the question of...
Let me get something from you. Let me see if I can get this straight. Andrew Cuomo now has $32 million that they admit to in the bank right now. We're told he's going into the campaign. He'll go into the campaign with at least $50 million.
Probably.
That's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Any political...
I'd like some of that if you'd give it to me.
Exactly. We had Rob Astorino
on... He could double my pension very quickly.
I bet he could.
We had Rob Astorino, who's running against him, on... And he said, just what you're saying. Doesn't matter. I have enough money to get my message out. I say, Bushu. I say, you know, you're not going to be able to turn on the radio or the television and not hear a Cuomo ad over and over again. First to cut taxes. First to do this, that, and that. It doesn't matter whether it's half true, whether it's all true. It just matters that that $50 million will buy you. And by the way, the friends of Cuomo, you know, the people who set up these other organizations just to make sure that things are good in New York State, but we know what they are putting ads on the television already during this time.
Is this
money? In other words, money talks, all others walk, the golden rule, those who have the gold rule, and I don't care what any highfalutin political scientist tells you out in Chicago or wherever he is.
All right,
you know,
Alan, when you raise campaign money,
yeah,
that money is spent largely on ads? Is that really what the bulk of this is spent on?
It's huge. It's a huge part of it, Raymond.
So if the ad rates, now, of course, this would kill the local radio stations and TV stations, but if the ad rates were set at a certain amount, wouldn't that mitigate some of the effect of big money?
I don't get it. I don't get the question. I know one thing. I know.
In other words, they spend a lot of money, and I ask, what is the majority of that money spent on?
It's ads. Yeah.
It's ads.
Yeah, and it's so direct mailings, and it's polling so that you ask what people want to hear, and then you give it back to them on a given day. It's all.
It's very counterintuitive what the political. And by the way, you should understand that I spent a lot of my career trenching on your field of political science by looking into these things and just finding out what the political science are doing. It's very counterintuitive what they're coming up with, which is that they can't find statistically that these things matter, even though it seems obvious to you and me that they ought to matter.
Yeah. So one of the things that I love about political scientists in general, and being coming out of that area, is that they sometimes don't know what the hell they're talking about. And
was that a shot?
Yeah, that was definitely a shot.
Oh, come on now.
Well, it's too bad.
Not my friends.
No. Well, no, you were talking to them, and you were saying it's counterintuitive, and that the rest of it. But you know, nobody loves you more than I do. But the fact of the matter, well, maybe your wife. But one thing is for sure. You can't tell me that if you get a good PR agency and they can make black into white and white into black and down into up, and that you spend a ton of money, that isn't going to help you. And, by the way, drive out the opposition. In other words, most people, it was unclear as to whether Andrew Cuomo was even going to have a major opponent.
Well, that's right. Yeah. A lot of the campaigns, nobody will go in. Nobody who might have a chance will go in because they view it as impossible.
Or you get one of those gazillionaires, you know, Palladino or Donald Trump, and they go in because the other party figures, well, you know, we really can't find anybody, but let that guy go spend his own money during that time. But yeah, money really does talk. I don't think there's any question in my mind.
Well, I think it does too. It's just a question of what's the mechanism is apparently incompletely understood how this works. But there's certainly a lot of evidence that the lesser funded campaign, if sufficiently high, and that's the concern.
Okay, what do you mean? What's the threshold?
Well, that's the issue, right? I can't give you a technical definition of that right now. What political scientists have been saying for years, and by the way, the ACLU is on the same page with this, is that the one real solution, although the public doesn't like it, is public funding. Because public funding gives the campaigns an alternative source so that whether it's unmatched or it's matched or whatever, they don't have to rely on these big givers.
But the problem is that the guys, Stephen, who have the most money always ignore the – because there's always a limit. They always said, okay, you get the public funding, but you only get it up to if you're willing to comply with the rules, and these are the rules. And then you get everybody saying, no, I'm not going to do it. Andrew Cuomo wouldn't do it without any question. What is that noise?
That's an alert. You have a meeting that perhaps we're missing?
Right now. Okay, I have to leave.
Yes.
Oh, you mean I can say anything I want now?
No, sir, you cannot.
It's an interesting discussion because, you know, a lot of the graybeards are saying, okay, you know, public funding. The people don't like it. You know why they don't like it? They're cynical. They think that the politicians are robbing everything that isn't held down,
right.
And therefore we're going to now pay them to run their elections with. They'll continue to find a way to milk the system. Maybe their wife will get the job. Maybe their cousin will get the job. Maybe their friend who runs a major charity in New York City.
I was just reading about wives and cousins in the 18th century, by the way.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
All of that's there. I think people are the people that are the empirical investigators are saying, well, their mantra has been floors, not ceilings for years, are saying that that's the best solution that they know.
Yeah, I have a better solution, I think, and very quickly.
Yes.
I do. And that is, I wrote a column on it this week, which is the minute the check is given to a campaign, let's say to the Cuomo campaign. I mean, we're now talking, he's got what they told me yesterday, 32, and it's going up. The minute the check goes into the bank, we get a copy of it, just like you do on your bank statement. You know, you go on and then you see a picture of the check.
So it becomes like a public account.
That's right. But not between 100,000 and 200,000, right. And not 6 weeks later or not 8 weeks later. The minute, and look, what is our campaign system? It's all about buying. It's all about buying influence. Everybody knows it. You know, you've got some client and you're a lobbyist and I remember a guy got into trouble years ago because he said the lobbyists were the handmaidens of the whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, the minute somebody gives you a check for $10,000, inevitably, with some small exceptions, they want some influence, they want something. So when you see policy outcome, some guy for casinos, for example, some guy who wants a casino and makes a major contribution to a political candidate, you better believe they're trying to buy something. And I want to know about it when they're buying it, not 6 weeks later.
Steve, last word before break.
They're clearly trying to buy something. Alan's absolutely right on that.
We would love to hear from you. The email address is roundtable@wamc.org, roundtable@wamc.org. And remember to take WAMC with you. Download our new mobile app for streaming audio, headlines, podcasts, and more. If you have the old one, best plan is to delete and then go to the iTunes or Google Play App Store, search WAMC, get the new app, and install. We'll be back.
Support for WAMC comes from Mohonk Preserve, New Paltz, presenting the Rock the Ridge 50-Mile Challenge for runners, walkers, hikers on May 3rd, sponsored by I Love New York and Ulster County Alive. RockTheRidge50.org for registration. Women's Health and Fitness Expo, Miller School, Kingston, featuring fitness demonstrations, seminars, workshops, and more this Saturday, 8:30 to 4 p.m., sponsored in part by MarkerTech, womenshealthexpo.com, and Pine Cobble School, Williamstown, Massachusetts, where on-campus goats are used for lessons in science and ecology. A good beginning never ends. PineCobble.org.
Relaxing music here on the Roundtable. 9:25 is the time. It's our panel. Alan Shartok is here. Good morning, Alan. Nice to have you.
Good morning.
Rosemary Armeo.
Which means I have to talk twice as much.
That's okay. Rosemary is missing in action.
MIA.
And she'll be here, though. Gosh darn it, I know it. And our very special guest today, Steve Gottlieb, the J. and Ruth Kaplan Distinguished Professor of Law at Albany Law School. Remember, you can email us at roundtable@wamc.org, roundtable@wamc.org. Do we have anything in the mailbag?
We do. Tony, who is a regular correspondent.
Okay.
T-O-N-I. She said, wow, Gottlieb looks different from his photo on his...
Oh, they're watching
book,
on video.
Morality Imposed. Yeah, you can watch. You go to WMC.org. And what does it say? Watch now? Or
yeah, there's
like
a link at the top right says right, watch
right
now.
I read his book before I entered law school. Rehnquist's Court's Morality Imposed looks liberal today because he didn't believe a corporation like the Bank of Boston has speech rights that can trump a Massachusetts referendum, as he said in his dissent. And that wasn't all we heard from Tony. She said something else.
Oh, really?
I don't know. Well, she's written three or four times today.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Is that it?
Well, let's see. There may be somebody else. Julius, who is also a regular correspondent.
All right.
It is not the direct influence on the winning candidate. It's the influencing of the electorate by the massive ads that are at stake here. The goal is to push a particular point of view to enough of the electorate to effectively gain control, and that's from Julius. And like that.
Okay. The email address, once again, is roundtable@wamc.org, roundtable@wamc.org. And since Stephen Gottlieb is here, we will talk about more news at the Supreme Court, but I think we'll wait until after our news, which comes in just 3 minutes.
Oh, okay.
So let's just talk about what happened in the NBA yesterday.
Okay, let's do
that. Big press conference. NBA Commissioner Adam Silver deployed what the New York Times calls the nuclear option on Tuesday, quoting here from the Times, to force the Los Angeles Clippers owner Donald Sterling out of the league for racist remarks he made in a recorded conversation. Now, will Silver's actions, banishing Sterling for life from team and league business and urging other owners to vote to force him to sell the club, withstand any legal challenges? So it's pretty clear that the NBA can ban him and fine him $2.5 million. The question is, can they successfully stop him from owning the team? I'm not a lawyer. We have a lawyer here, though. What do you think?
Well, I have to start by saying don't know. But this court has, in the last few years, taken apart a lot of the antitrust laws so that it is now much harder to bring and win an antitrust case than it was before. I'm not sure that that change will affect the initial question with respect to basketball, and I don't know if the ruling has been extended to basketball, but you'll remember that the antitrust laws have not been treated as extending to baseball.
They have an exemption.
They have an exemption. I don't know. I just simply don't know whether that is true of other major sports, but that's the initial question.
Help me with my ignorance, guys. Why does antitrust enter into this?
Okay, now that is the question. And apparently the way it is laid out for me, and of course not being an expert, if this is from the Times, if at least 23 of the 30 NBA owners vote Sterling out, legal experts said that he could sue the league, arguing that the other owners conspired in violation of antitrust law to harm his business or overstep their constitutional authority by kicking him out. Well, we only have a minute here.
The issue in the antitrust laws is a combination of conspiracy and restraint of trade. And there are a couple of different laws, and some of them are worded a little bit differently, but it's the combination.
But he can really hold things up because he can sue. And he has, he's a lawyer.
If the court gives him an injunction. Yeah,
however, sure. The NBA could say, you are harming our product. We have sponsors leaving in droves. We have players who will sit. We will have fans who won't go. You're harming the entire product.
Yeah, but I think the guy's a jackass, but I don't think that's what's in play right here.
Okay.
We're talking about something else.
All right. We have to take a break here. The email address is roundtable@wamc.org. Roundtable@wamc.org. I'll go outside. We'll take a look for Rosemary, and we'll be back. Welcome back to the Roundtable on WAMC. It's 9:36, a Wednesday morning. It's the panel. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. Alan Shartok is here, and we're also joined by Steve Gottlieb, the J. and Ruth Kaplan Distinguished Professor of Law at Albany Law School. The email address here is roundtable@wamc.org. And Alan, we have mail.
We have mail. Okay. Now remember, folks, keep them short, because otherwise we'll be here forever.
That's true.
John writes, the cure for getting money out of politics isn't public financing or different contribution limits. Those are symptoms of the problem. The cure is taking control of our public airwaves. Again, our government regulates and provides television and radio airwaves on behalf of the people. If we insisted that major candidates for office were to be given political airtime for free for a limited period of time, 3 months would be plenty of time to campaign. There would be no need for the nonstop fundraising now needed to compete in the political arena. Of course, the media moguls such as the Murdochs of the world would protest such a move would harm the profitability of those companies that control the airwaves. Now, the public good is a greater good than any media company's bottom line, John.
But can I just say one thing?
Sure. You want to answer?
The days of the mom and pop radio station are
gone.
Fast, done. There are a few. But that would certainly harm those entities as well. In other words, that's a big bread and butter time for those who are independently owned commercial radio stations.
Okay. Andrew writes, a thought about the NBA press conference yesterday. So remarkably refreshing to see Adam Silver render a decision speaking frankly to the issues, not to duck any questions and answer all questions directly. He seems to be doing justice to his predecessor, David Stern. It's also interesting to note all the bloggers and internet unconventional news sources that were credentialed into the press conference and who were called on to ask questions of the commissioner.
Can I interject here?
Yeah,
come
sure.
on in. You're going to need a microphone to interject.
Yeah, you got to get closer.
Because in one sense, I'm delighted that this happened, because there are so many people who don't believe that racism still exists. And people in my business see it all the time.
How do you see it?
Now, this is with the ACLU?
Well, no, I mean, as a teacher of constitutional law, because I'm aware of all the different lines of cases, and you're following the reasons why things are happening to people, and so you kind of get into the nitty gritty, or at least I do, and you see the way that what some people call institutional racism is there. You see the way other people like to just ignore what's happening, and the way that the court has made it impossible to prove discrimination. So basically has swept the problem under the rug, but that didn't mean that it went away.
But what about affirmative action? We see the court doing that in Michigan case. Very interesting. You've had some thoughts on that.
Well, I was saying in the break that that's an area where there's been a lot of discussion in recent weeks among the teachers of constitutional law about the Shuett case.
Yeah.
And
well, the Shuett case for
the Shuett case is the one where the court decided that it was okay for Michigan to ban doing anything about
the voters.
By vote, a referendum,
yeah,
to ban anything that would take account of racial disparities.
In university
admissions. Right.
Right.
So there's been a lot of discussion up one side, down the other about that case. But from my perspective, what's happened in the court is all the court has simply been hostile in every context to doing anything. So I was just saying it's made it hard to prove discrimination. And at the same time that it's been making it impossible to account for or deal with the disparities. So it's not that the court is in favor of equality. What the court has been doing is made it impossible even to root out discrimination.
Yeah, well, there's a difference.
And so people like me think of the court simply, and by the way, it hasn't made it impossible to deal with other forms of discrimination. It's just made it impossible to deal with racial discrimination. It's actually held several statutes, not just the recent Voting Rights Act, but several statutes dealing with racial discrimination. It's held pieces of those statutes unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. Because those statutes were willing to look at a form of evidence, which is if the owner of the Clippers had kept his mouth shut and you were trying to see whether he was a racist, you would try to figure out, well, what has he done? If you've got good counsel, you don't open your mouth. But
brain.
What do you mean?
Well,
the counsel would have told him, listen, keep shut.
That's right.
You keep shut. Don't go, you know, talking about even in your most personal telephone calls.
But the court won't let us bring in evidence of behavior because, in its mind, that doesn't prove motive, and it only is interested in motive.
Well, right. Look who's here. That's an interesting point. Rosemary just walked in, and while Rosemary sets up, I'll ask you this question.
No, I'm following along the very interesting theme here, but I'm a little bit confused, and that confusion is this. The Michigan voters said, let's say your mother, a mother in Michigan, and your kid is applying to law school, and the law school says, no, look, historically, people of color are so discriminated against that they go to the head of the line, and you're the mother of the kid who is now going to maybe be pushed out as a result of that. And you vote no, hell no, when it comes to the vote.
I get that, Alan, and I understand the very strong sense that people have that equality means colorblindness.
Right.
The problem that I have is that under that rubric, this court has also pushed out mm-hmm. any way of proving discrimination when it's racial discrimination. Gender discrimination is very different because, in a sense, gender discrimination is like pre-Brown versus Board because it comes in the context of no women need apply. right? So it's right on the surface. But once you get past that, are blacks or women actually allowed? Is there a glass ceiling? How would you prove that there's a glass ceiling? Well, normally, lawyers would do it by showing...
A Brandeis brief.
Well, yes.
Yeah, saying, look,
what Alan is referring to is a brief that Louis Brandeis, actually, and his wife wrote in the early part of the 20th century, which actually consisted of a lot of quotations from various social scientists about the impact on women. But what you'd actually do is you'd show who was available, who was promoted, what their qualifications were. You'd go through a statistical analysis and you'd say, it's pretty obvious we're excluding women, or it's pretty obvious we're excluding blacks, or whatever. But the court won't allow that to happen. So to me, what the court is doing is being swept under this rug of racial colorblindness, but actually is much more targeted than that.
The email address here is roundtable@wamc.org, roundtable@wamc.org, joined by Stephen Gottlieb of Albany Law School, Alan Shartok. Rosemary Armeo is here. We'll take a break, and we'll get Rosemary set up, and we'll be back to the mailbag in a moment.
Support for WAMC comes from Storm King Art Center, Cornwall, New York, presenting the new exhibition Zhang Wan, Evoking Tradition, and the site-specific installation of Outlooks by Virginia Overton, opening May 3rd, stormking.org. Spring House Spa, Sharon Springs, New York. A modern-day spa in a historic setting. Offering Mother's Day gift certificates online, springhousespa.com. And MKC Kitchen and Bath Center, Troy. Offering a range of cabinetry, including Showplace wood products, countertops, design services, and showroom, mkckitchens.com.
Welcome back to our roundtable panel. 9:46 is the time. Joined by Alan Shartok, Stephen Gottlieb, Ray Graff here, and Rosemary Armeo. Nice to have you with us this morning.
Thank you so much.
We got to get you one of those little alerts that went off on Alan's iPhone earlier. That
tinga 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 tinga.
I have a doctor's excuse.
Okay.
I'll present it after the program.
That's quite all right. Nice to have you here. We have been talking about
lots of things
pertaining to the Supreme Court. And Alan, we have more mail.
Eric says, the NBA's action preserves the value of the team, which was beginning to crumble since the recording became public. So the $2.5 million fine is simply a commission that Sterling will pay for the opportunity to sell the team for 30 times what he bought it for, and that's from Eric. Well, yes and no. I mean, if I'm this character, I'm going to be knowing that I'm going to my grave at the end. I mean, he's over 80 years old, with this stigma on me that I have been branded a racist. Let me tell you, I know one guy who got kicked off of Wall Street. Eventually, who knows, he got a pardon from the president at the same time. Mark, what was his name? You remember that guy who got kicked out? Well, anyway, yeah. But anyway, he got a pardon. But, you know, this will always, the guys like this always remember these insults. This is a tremendous stamp on his forehead, I think. Don't you, Ray?
Do I?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, how long he'll have to live with it is a question only for,
the Almighty.
The Almighty.
Yes. If you can believe what the press is reporting about him, I don't know whether he considers it a stamp or a badge of honor, which is really
the scary thing. I don't think so.
All right.
I don't think so. He was just about to get an award from the NAACP. He's given money. This was his most private thought over a telephone, and he got caught. He got caught. And which goes to
There's
show
also
you.
Also, a question about the legality of what happened in California.
It's illegal.
Yeah, we talked about that yesterday. Who did it? And if it's the ex-wife, she's in the news today because she has apparently quite a history of racist remarks and racist sentiment. So, if the sale, remember we discussed the sale could be to her, we may end up in the same boat that we're in.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see. What else?
And Michael says, how many NBA players have been convicted of an assortment of felonies, wife beating, weapons possession, assault? They're still playing.
Dog fighting. Yeah.
They're still playing. They satisfy some sham of a rehab program and continue to play. They bring in the money. That's the bottom line. Sterling gets barred for life for some stupid remarks to his mistress. No rehab for him. He's expendable. And the NBA takes on the politically correct action. I'm not defending this idiot racist, says Michael. Let's just have some equality of punishment.
That's an interesting point.
Well, it is, but it isn't. In other words, when you're a player, you're governed by the collective bargaining agreement between the Players Association and the league. When you are an owner, there is a constitution in the NBA that you sign on to. Now, it's very broad. There's really nothing in it that says you can't be an idiot. You can't say racist things. You can't think racist things.
Not that
ultimately,
specifically.
Ultimately, that's the thought police anyway. Yeah. You should have the right to be an idiot if you want. However, the NBA says, listen, if you are detrimental to this league, and really that comes down to the big dollar sign,
that's right.
You can be thrown out.
Right. Which kind of provision, of course, the government can't have. That kind of provision only works because this is a private contract,
right. And
they get to make a decision. But in government behavior, we wouldn't allow that kind of discretion.
Because it's so broad.
It would be a violation of due process.
Well, one thing is for sure, his history goes back some 30 years with this team. Litigation, he enjoys. If I were a betting man, I would say he won't take this lying down.
Some of my students need cases to litigate. That would be great. that'd be fine.
Maureen Dowd has an interesting column today. I love ranting about her because I think she's just phoning it in these days. But her point is that the commissioner made a very bold and popularly bold decision. And that even if he loses in court, fine, he still did the right thing. And maybe President Obama should act the same way.
Her point
is that the commissioner is acting more presidential than the president. And taking a stand for the right thing, even if you're doomed not to get your point of view across. So I just throw it out there.
That's a very interesting perspective. I think that's right.
In other words, we don't want presidents to act like politicians, even though they are. And they are subject to very major constraints on their behavior.
Listen, it's the worst job in the world.
It's
the job everybody wants. You know, if you're a politician, you'd love to be president and get there.
I only wanted that job when I was a kid. But now I'd do anything but.
You know, I think if that were her real point, I would have liked the column. Instead, it seemed to me that she did want you to act like a politician. Her point is that Obama is not acting presidential. He's saying things like, I'm in this for the long run. I don't need satisfaction right away, but I have to fix my paragraph in history. So let me back. He's acting like a reasonable person and a thinker rather than a politician.
Well, don't you think that's right?
I mean,
to me, the idea that he doesn't want any more boots on the ground, that's always an easy fix.
Dramatic fix.
The bands come out, the people rave, and then hell breaks loose. So I think what's great about this man is the fact that he is a thinker and does do what's right, which is unpolitical in the short range sense. And I think that's great.
I don't see any problem with his thinking what should be done before acting. But I have managed to switch this from sports to politics.
I love it. That's what you do, Rosemary, and you
different?
Do it so well.
Money talks in both fields, right?
I love it.
That's a very good point.
Money talks in all fields.
The email here is roundtable@wamc.org. Alan, that it out of the mailbag?
Well, you know, some people write several times.
Yes.
And
one,
so,
two customers,
well,
the rule?
One or two. Oh, I mean, one or two. And even when they're very good.
Okay.
Even when they're very good, they're very good. But, you know, I want to give everybody a chance to get in. Professor, we have one letter here who wants to know when all these campaign finance rules sort of came into being.
Basically, they're Watergate rules.
Uh-huh.
So
this was seen as the fix.
Well, it started before the resignation. Nixon resigned in 1974, and there was a statute that went back to 1972, but then it got modified several times before it actually went into effect in 1976 after the Buckley versus Vallejo case. But all these particular numbers go back to that Watergate era.
Yeah.
And of course, they've been changed. Congress put a COLA, cost of living adjustment, on it at one point. Because otherwise, of course, numbers just get to be ridiculous.
It struck me that the story we discussed yesterday, Representative Grimm being under indictment now, remember that began as a look into his campaign financing, and then switched to his business. And it occurred to me that one reason for the switch, aside from the good clues leading him that way, leading investigators there, was that they didn't think they could get the case through with the laws very much now, don't you think, in flux because of the Supreme Court decisions and the obvious leaning. I'm not sure they could get a
Well, it depends what they were going after, and I'm not sure the details of what they were investigating.
Well, so Steve writes a too long letter, but I no, well, it's very good, but I think the art of
I didn't write a letter.
No, not you.
Not that.
But a different Steve. But let me see if I can do justice to the letter, which is basically there are always hidden costs in every decision. Hidden costs in dollars, doctors, sectors, people unfairly bearing them. I think the creators of the hidden costs should bear these contests instead. Alternatively, the legislature can decide to have the people subsidize these hidden costs and pass the legislation necessary to make that happen. This seems to be an effective way to get the message out, complete with a simple spreadsheet. And then he says, and this is my favorite sentence, but it has it's certainly not justified. He says, am I just off in La La Land?
No.
No.
You're
no
an
comment. I can't say that. Don't know where the email came from.
That's a different debate. I'm sorry. That's a different debate. Ray was objecting to my leaning back in the comfortable chair.
Way back.
But that's the argument about so-called tax expenditures, because the deductions are, in effect, expenditures. Just as much as what the government actually writes a check for. So that point really comes out of that discussion.
Well, E called, wrote in and said at WMC.org, and although I deplore Mr. Sterling's racial statements, these statements were private in nature. How were these statements recorded and leaked?
That is a question.
Can privately held beliefs be basis to force someone to sell their interest in a business? Apparently so. Again,
depends,
although I deplore
is.
His views, he has a right to them. You know, one of the things that has been rolling around in my rather cramped brain has been the idea that you're asking for an affirmative vote for a percentage of the owners, right?
Right.
And every one of those owners has got to be saying, I wonder what I said on the telephone thinking that it was a secure way of testing ideas or saying something or being provocative. What I said that could lose me my team.
Yeah.
This is definitely becoming a society in which there isn't a moment where we can speak in an unguarded way or write in an unguarded way anymore. That's gone. You're basically on stage all the time. And I think most of us have to get used to that if we haven't already.
It's tough for a culture and a world to suddenly be in that stage where there is no private conversation and there is no private correspondence. And if you're on a stage, then does the world at some point get a terrible case of stage fright, performance anxiety, if you will? And does that collapse civilization?
Let me also add to the listener's comment. Was that Steve or somebody else who said that he has a right to his views? And that's true. But let's understand that when we're talking about rights, we're talking about what the government can't take away from you. But that doesn't mean that in social contexts or business contexts, others can't say, you have a right to that, but you don't have a right to make me swallow it.
Well, Ted says, so now as a society, it is no longer actions that will get you into trouble. What you think and how you feel, bigots, for example, will determine whether you can own a business. P.S. It's interesting how since 9/11 and the internet, people's sense of a right to privacy continues to shift back and forth.
Boy, isn't that interesting?
Extremely Orwellian. Right. These what we're talking about.
Yes,
here.
The thought police.
Coming back from Europe, it's really interesting. The Europeans are much more strict about privacy issues than we are, and I'm thinking of the French president who. Let me get this right. He was living with a woman, not his wife or the woman he had children with, and was having an affair with an actress and then objected to that coming out.
C'est la vie. All right, we're done. A roundtable at WAMC.org. Rosemary, thanks for being here. Steve Gottlieb, great to have you here. Alan Chartok, nice to have you here as well. I'm Ray Graff. Hour two of the roundtable on the way.